This hour is brought to you by AlmostFreeTeeth.com. Save on dental implants today.
Arm talent. I mean, you know, arm talent. He could extend plays when he wants to. He does not necessarily want to run, per se, although he'll do that. He's hurt some people doing that, but he can, his arm talent, his ability to fit the ball in multiple locations and push the ball down the field with accuracy, you know, it really stands out.
Eric Washington, Bears defensive coordinator, talking about C.J. Stroud, against whom the Bears will be playing Sunday night. Let's find out more about the Texans with our old friend Ron Hughley, afternoon host at Sports Radio 610 in Houston, on Twitter at Real Ron Hughley, with us on the Circus Sports Illinois hotline. Download the Circus Sports app today, twitch.tv/Chicago670 The Score. Good to talk to you again, sir. How you been?
I'm good. How y'all boys doing? That's what I want to know. How y'all fellas doing?
The way you have that chipper in your voice tells me that you have a better disposition towards this game on Sunday night than maybe the people in the city of Chicago do.
I'm just a lot going on over there. I'm just certainly curious how y'all doing. That's all I'm feeling right now, baby.
All good here. Hopeful that the Bears offense is going to improve against yet another strong defensive test, man. But this is not one that people here expect the Bears to win it, and hasn't been, regardless of where they are. But it's complicated a little bit by the rookie hiccups that we saw from the exciting quarterback in the first game. What's the feeling down there about C.J. Stroud's sophomore campaign?
Well, Stroud in particular, obviously confident. I mean, these people don't know what to do with themselves about C.J. Stroud. Even some of the, you know, mistake. I say he's in God mode right now. He can do whatever. And to the point that you made there, we had a remote yesterday, and the first two people we saw was two Bears fans.
Oh, really?
And Dan, they walked up to us. They had all their Bears stuff on. I mean, I first quick glance, I thought they were Astros fans because they were wearing orange. But no, you could see it was Bears. He came up to me and whispered to me in my ear, "I don't think we're going to win on Sunday."
Wait a sec. So you not only did you run into Bears fans, you ran into realistic Bears fans?
Yeah.
Wow.
I said, damn.
I think more people are realistic about this week than people want to admit. Tell us just when you say, like, he's in God mode, obviously, C.J. Stroud, like, what are the biggest weaknesses right now for him as an individual, as a quarterback? I mean, he's obviously not a finished product. It's year two. It's the beginning of year two, you know, and I think people forget sometimes that C.J. Stroud, Caleb Williams, I think they're a month apart in age. So, like, what can you tell us about him in terms of his weakness? I mean, does he have a kryptonite?
Yeah, I think so. Listen, when I say God mode, I'm talking about with the fans.
Like, okay, how they treat him.
However Michael Jordan is in Chicago, that's pretty much where C.J. Stroud is.
Whoa.
And that's where I am every day. Hey, don't let Ron say something critical of C.J. Stroud. They want me to go move back to Kansas City every chance you get. Now, this is the deal to me with C.J. And listen, I think it's going to become an exciting brand of football. But his level of confidence from last year is through the roof. His level of confidence in the guys around him, with the Stephon Diggs addition and Nico Collins, who's gone off, and Tank Dell and the backs with Joe Mixon, his level of confidence in those guys is through the roof. See, last year he was about the, hey, I'll take the boring stuff. I'll take the easy stuff. Hey, I won't try to push the thing. I won't take a chance if the defense is giving me 7 yards. I'm going to give them that. No, not this year. CJ done got a little confidence. And I love it. And I think it's going to be better. He is now throwing the ball in traffic. He is now have confidence to push the ball and try to make plays. CJ is not just about this taking the boring stuff. He is trying to make plays. And if you watch the game, he put the ball in harm's way more often than he did. Last year, he threw 5 interceptions. He threw about 3 or 4 intercepting type balls. I'm talking about running to your right and throwing it back to the middle of the field. He had one picked off, but it was a penalty. He threw another one. The guy just couldn't keep his foot in bounds. I think the big turn is the Colts showed him something different They took away the early first moves and first reads and made him have to do more and look at more of the field. So I don't like he was fine in the game to his standards. He was fine in the game, but you are seeing teams are trying to do different things to him and not just let him see what he saw a lot of last year.
What are they doing?
Like I said, I think they're making him hold the ball longer. Like it was CJ. Hey, I'll take it quick, baby. I'll take these first reads and have nothing, no problem with it. I think they're trying to put more pressure on him. I know Flus likes to sit in zones, which is could be problematic because I think he could kill that, especially with the receivers. But the Colts said, to hell with that, man. We're going to send a lot of pressure, and we're going to play up tight and try to take away the very first read you have. And I think that is the adjustment. And he talked about it this week. We left some plays out there. I left some plays out there. I could have helped my offensive line and my offense a little bit better than I did.
You mentioned Matt Eberflus. He gave Bobby Slowick a big compliment when asked about C.J. Stroud and his success and his development. And Eberflus said he's been coached well to stay in the pocket. And not only is that a compliment to a guy who I thought was going to leave for a head coaching job last year in Slowick, but it also, I think, gave us an indication as to how they want to develop their own quarterback. Do you agree?
No, I do, and you can see their games are very similar because in just this aspect, I don't want to get anybody to twist up words, in just this aspect of their games in terms of when they choose to run and when they choose and how they choose to negotiate the pocket, it's Mahomes-like, right? Like Mahomes doesn't just take off and run all the time. A lot of times Mahomes is moving in the pocket to create a better throwing lane or to buy some time. It's not just to take off. I think CJ does that too. But when CJ does take off, like he had a big run in this game against the Colts, you know, it's kind of sparingly. But I think Caleb is in that same vein to kind of buy time instead of just taking off and moving in the pocket, not to run, but moving in the pocket to try to get somebody else open.
I want to follow up on something you said when you talked about him throwing in harm's way more often now. I don't know if that's very, very recent, as in just the season opener this year, or is that something he was doing in the playoffs last year? But the reason I want to know more about that is because, as you mentioned, he's only thrown five picks, and he's been so good at protecting the football. Well, this Bears team, as you know, is a very opportunistic defensive team. They invite that because they feel like that's where they can make their hay, if you will. Do you feel like that's going to be a bigger challenge for him now, or is he habitually line-stepping in terms of trying to, you know, take more risk? Or do you think because he had put the ball in harm's way this last game, he might dial it back a notch?
No, I think this is kind of the next step that he's taken. I think we see it. When I say in harm's way, I don't think he's going to go. He's not about to be, you know, Jameis. But I mean, but the great quarterbacks in the league, Mahomes and Josh Allen and these guys, they'll take chances and not necessarily just take the check down, but they'll take a chance when they feel confident in their guys. And like when he gets out to roam, I think in year one, it was like, hey, this is the NFL. This is a new level. Let me just take what they're giving me. Let me learn the game a little bit more. Now he has the utmost confidence in the guys, especially like him and Tank Dell seem to have a really good, and he would be the one I would watch on off script plays. Him and Tank Dell seem to have a really good connection when it comes to that. And he's got confidence that his guys will go up and make a play. And I just think the natural progression of confidence in the game has jumped up. And it is definitely something we have talked about this week is Brisker and Johnson. And we saw Stevenson get the pick six. I don't know what Will was doing there, but whatever. Like we saw them get the pick six. They are a group that will pick the ball off. And to me, I think that's the biggest chance for the Bears is it feels like what we watched last week, that they're a team that would need help to stay in this game. And CJ probably should dial it back, but I don't think he will. I think he will continue to take chances. But I think for the Bears, that's the way that I think they stay in the game, is if he makes some of these mistakes.
How good do the Texans think they are? And I don't mean that snarkily. I mean, as far as where they have set reasonable expectations. I mean, knowing getting past Patrick Mahomes and the Chiefs in their conference is certainly a tall order. But do they believe that they're contenders?
Absolutely. I think they believe they're contenders. And I'm a actions over words, and their actions in the offseason screamed, we feel like we are going to take a run at it.
How so?
We're damn near all in. I mean, you go out and you get a Danielle Hunter, and you pay him like a huge contract, but only in 2 years because you're trying to keep the windows with your quarterback and your other big players. They go out. They were trying to get Keenan Allen, who the Bears end up getting, but they get Diggs. They brought in Joe Mixon. They were trying to get Saquon Barkley, but they had to kind of come down to get Mixon. They're inside. The only places where they struggled, they tried to swing and get Eric Armstead, but he went to the Jags, even though they thought they had a deal done there. They have tried to make a ton of moves to add to the roster of ready now star potential Pro Bowl level players to add to this group. And you can just also see from day one in training camp, there was a different type of swagger. There was a different type of feel of, you know, we have confidence. This isn't just the, hey, man, can we win 7 to 10 games and can we compete? There is a different level of confidence with this entire group, and they look and feel like a team. I covered the Chiefs for years.
You still do cover the Chiefs.
And I still do cover the Chiefs, but I covered them day to day and saw them day to day. You could see the flip from Mahomes when he, you know, his first rookie season to the next year, and you could see this team felt like they were in a different level and carried themselves in a different level. And I think I'm seeing a little bit of that from the Texans at the start of this year.
Ron, you mentioned the offseason moves and just going kind of an all now while we've got this quarterback on a rookie contract thing that the Texans are doing. The Joe Mixon move, I think a lot of people, because of how we look at running backs, you know, run them till the wheels fall off. Getting him in now, his eighth year, and to see the workload that he had, 30 carries, 159 yards, 3 catches, 33 yards in week one, and to hear Bobby Slowick say, hey, it's not really something that's we think is a problem for him to have that many carries. How much of a difference is he making in the backfield, and especially when you talk about being able to maybe get a lead and just run that clock, because he was giving me clock-killing Corey Dillon vibes watching that game against the Colts.
Well, yeah, that was the story of the game. I don't know who the hell was out there in those 5 uniforms in front of them. I've never seen that offensive line block like that. Kenyon Green, I didn't think could play football. And he came out there and he just absolutely mauled and destroyed people in a way I've never seen before. They even influenced Laremy Tunsil to get a little tough. I mean, he's a pass blocker, but hell, he ran somebody over. And I don't know if I've seen Laremy do that in 4 years. But Joe Mixon was a big story in his ability to run the zone. It's huge to see it from a guy in Damian Pierce who's still kind of trying to learn when to cut back and how to operate in that system. But you can see Joe seems to cut back in the perfect lanes at the perfect time and runs that to perfection. But I'm going to tell you the truth. He didn't really have to make a lot of decisions. I mean, that line was pushing the Colts, and I'm talking DeForest Buckner and company, pushing the Colts 4 or 5 yards off the ball before he was even having to make a decision on what he needed to do. So Joe Mixon's a big deal, and I believe Bobby Slowick's lying, by the way. 33 touches.
Yeah, that's a lot.
For a ball game, you might want to pull that back just a bit. I'll be honest, and I was one that wondered, the Cincinnati Bengals are in win-now mode. This is before they played the Patriots. They're in win-now mode. Why in the world would they let him go for Zach Moss and pay Zach Moss more than they would actually have to pay Joe Mixon? There was something that jumped out to me. Do they know something? Well, week one, they didn't know nothing. he was injured a lot during camp, which was kind of an eye-opener thing. He missed like 3 weeks of camp with a leg injury. But, man, Sunday, like that's the big thing. Y'all, the linebackers and Edmonds and Brisker in the secondary, he's going to finish a run now. They better be ready to go. He is moving forward. I don't think I ever saw him get tackled and didn't fall forward one time in that game. So he's a big key. If the Texans can run the football like they did last week, now we're in a different space. Now we're talking about the Chiefs and the Ravens. Oh. If they can consistently do that.
Why did Bobby Slowick stay?
I just don't think he found the right spot. I was surprised that more teams didn't come after him. I don't know that he really actually got offered a gig, Dan. I don't. Now, I think him and Johnson in Detroit are going to be the top two guys if this thing goes the same way, as long as he doesn't get Mike Kafka. And I don't think he's dealing with Daniel Jones. He's got C.J. Stroud, so he should be fine. But I just don't think it was out there as much for him. And the big knock on him in the 1 year and now, like, this will take off if it continues, is his struggles in developing a run game. He hadn't been able to develop a run game at all last year. And week one, they looked like the place he came from, the 49ers. That's what they looked like in the run game. So if they can continue, but no, he's a real deal. Bobby Slowick, that's the thing is, and I know you guys are dealing with this, you know, what is Shane Waldron? What is the
comp?
We didn't know who he was. He had never put together an offense. He had never had to call plays. And then he came in and you could see it within 3 or 4 weeks, like, oh, they got one of the good ones out of that tree. They didn't get one of the bad ones. They didn't get the Nathaniel Hacketts. They got one of the good ones out of that tree. And he has been an absolute game changer on the sideline.
You could have said Luke Getsy instead of Nathaniel Hackett.
I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to do that to Bears fans. I didn't want to do that. I don't know how Luke somehow got him a job with the Raiders.
Yeah, he did.
To do the same thing, but I didn't want to do that to you.
Ron, thanks so much, man. We'll talk again soon.
All right.
That is Ron Hughley, afternoon host at Sports Radio 610 in Houston. This segment has been brought to you by AlmostFreeTeeth.com. Save on dental implants today. Joe Ostrowski will join us next, and he will give you all kinds of tips for your wagertainment weekend, as he does. It is a sign of Friday when Joe arrives, and that's next on The Score.
Bernstein and Holmes, your midday destination for Chicago sports talk on 670 The Score.
I have a daily sports betting show.
We couldn't live without Joe Ostrowski.
Oh, yeah. He's got a lot of Herbert Hoover in him. I got to tell you that much.
Joe Ostrowski is brought to you by Four Seasons Heating, Air Conditioning, Plumbing, and Electric. For all the right reasons, call 866-4-SEASONS. He always joins us as part of our Football Fridays, brought to you by Four Seasons Heating, Air Conditioning, Plumbing, and Electric, and presented by your local Ford dealers and It's Not a Game, Illinois.com. He joins us on the Circa Resort and Casino Hotline, CircaLasVegas.com, and Twitch.tv/Chicago670 The Score. Hello, Joe. How are you?
Doing fantastic. Getting ready for another full weekend of football. And I got to tell you, I know we'll start with Bears here. There was immediate line movement, not since Sunday night, not a ton, but it was funny. So they make point spreads on every game before the season starts. And after the games were a wrap, late afternoon, they put a number on the Bears and the Texans.
Okay.
And it was the same number they had preseason, which was the Texans favored by only 3.5. And then once that got out there and people realized exactly how the Bears won, the bettors came in heavy. Like, no, this is wrong. This is going to be much closer to 6.5 and 7. That's where we went. It was up there for maybe an hour. And then it went from 3.5 to 6.5. That's where we're at right now. It wouldn't surprise me if we get to a touchdown by game time on Sunday night, because what happens is a lot of people bet moneyline parlays. They just pick the winner of all these games. And then there ends up being a lot of liability for people that have some good tickets going on the Texans side. So it might be Texans -7 in this one. But that 3.5 did not last once people realized, whoa, that was a pretty fluky result. Maybe the flukiest result that we're going to see all year, the Bears winning the way that they did.
Joe, but knowing what you know and knowing it was week one and we all overreact, I mean, where are you on this with the overreaction from those results affecting what bettors do the following week?
Yeah, I mean, this is the big week where you're seeing overreaction all over the board. So There was some chatter in the offseason. Oh, maybe the Panthers aren't that bad. Oh, no, they're worse. They might be worse.
Yes, they are.
Yeah.
Oh, no, they're that bad. They're that bad.
The Chargers went from a 3.5-point favorite to a 6.5-point favorite, and they're traveling across the country, and we don't even really know what the Chargers are at this point, but people are like, no, there's no chance. I'm going to go against them. A lot of overreaction. So Kansas City, Cincinnati looks terrible. We don't know about Burrow's wrist. That line goes from 3 to 5.5, 6-point range. So yes, there is definite overreaction. If you bet against the overreaction, a lot of times you're going to end up being profitable. Jordan Love injury. The betting market is telling us that Jordan Love is worth 7, 8, 9 points. No, he's not. We're not even that sure. We're not even positive what he is, if they should have paid him as much. He put together one hell of a half of a season, but the Packers went from a 5-point favorite to now, okay, Love is out, Willis is in. Now the Colts are favored by 3 at Lambeau Field. So yeah, it's the biggest overreaction week of the season.
What are the prop numbers for some individual stats telling us about Bears-Texans?
Yeah, so the thing is, you want to look at receivers because there's so much uncertainty that if Keenan's out, if Rome's out, DJ Moore's going to be the play because he's going to get all the targets. But they're smart enough, they're waiting until we get final word. You could get DJ Moore 2-1 for an anytime touchdown there, but as far as receptions, receiving yards, they're holding off on that until we get word on the other guys. Caleb Williams, he's a favorite to throw an interception. He's minus 155. After going sub 100 in game one, they put the passing yards at 216.5 in this one. 37.5 attempts, I believe low 20s in the completions. On the Stroud side, they put it at 263.5 yards. They have a great group of receivers,
wow,
but also that's the strength of that Bears defense, the secondary that they have.
So I also think on that 216 number, the way I would look at that is everybody who would think the Bears are going to be trailing and the Texans might be comfortable midway through the third, and he's facing a shell defense that is allowing things underneath to allow them to rally up in chunks of 12 and 8 and 14. It's pretty easy to get to that number, even if the Bears are outclassed.
Yeah, and if that's the game script we're dealing with, we could also get to the over, which I could certainly see here. I have questions about the Texans' secondary. Now, Stingley's great, but they're starting two rookies back there. And last week in the opener, Anthony Richardson had 3 50-plus yard pass completions.
I'd say he blew the top off of their defense, but I don't think there was a top. He was just throwing off his back foot to the, I mean, come on.
Bombs, just bombs. Now, yeah, if Caleb completes one of those, the city's going to go crazy. But I think we could end up seeing more points in this one. And if we get word that a couple of receivers are out, Dalton Schultz has also not been practicing for the Texans, maybe that total comes down a little bit. So 45.5 going over that could be an interesting look.
When you look at the college slate, what jumps out to you? I mean, I know it's not the most illustrious group pairing of teams, but from a bettor's angle, you can just pick and choose.
Yeah, it's bad. It's a bad weekend. It might be one of those Saturdays where, you know, once we get into conference play next week, you're going to want to be in front of your TV. But yeah, there's not a lot of great matchups. The ones that do have my attention, you've got Alabama visiting Wisconsin. That's 16.5. I don't think the Badgers are going to be able to score enough to hang with Alabama there. So I could see that one being a route. Florida State's back in action. You know, last year they go undefeated. They're mad they don't make the playoff, and then they start 0-2 this year with DJU. They're a 6.5-point favorite. The pros were betting them early on in the week. It went from 5 up to 6.5. They are hosting Memphis. That's interesting. How does Notre Dame respond after what happened last week? They're still a now double-digit favorite at Purdue, and it looks like Riley Leonard is injured. I don't know if quarterback play could possibly get worse for the Irish.
Yeah, I was going to say that may not be a bad thing as watching him perform.
Right. The number's gone down a little bit. A lot of spots going down to 9.5 there. And anytime Deion's a favorite, I want to go the other way. So Deion's favored by 7. against rival now Colorado State. Remember, they got into it with the head coach last year, but a lot of people betting Colorado State +7, +7.5. So, there are a few interesting matchups as far as that goes.
I think for me, knowing that the college slate is bad, and you're looking at the NFL, is there a specific game that like really has you salivating come Sunday?
I want to Chiefs Bengals.
Yeah, well that's probably everybody, right? Like it's Joe Burrow against the Chiefs, and he's been kind of their I guess the closest thing to a weak spot for Andy Reid and company, right?
For sure, and you don't ever want to go against Andy Reid when he has extra time to prepare, and that is certainly the situation here. Burrow with the rest, we don't know. But what we do know is, yes, Burrow's not scared to go into Arrowhead and perform well. He's had some ridiculous games. Chase had a 3-touchdown game against them in the past. He's great as an underdog, but the problem is the Bengals are terrible in the first 2 weeks of the season. With Burrow, they are 1-8 straight up in the first 2 weeks. So for some reason, Zach Taylor's not getting this team to prepare to play from the outset. We saw that last week, losing to the Patriots. Not a whole lot of people were predicting that one, but anytime you're giving Joe Burrow 5.5, 6 points, can he make it a one score game? Yeah, I think so. We were a half of a toe from the Chiefs losing the opener against the Ravens, and the Ravens had their issues throughout that game. So I think they can hang. It doesn't look like T. Higgins is going to be available, though, so that could hurt Cincinnati.
I don't know if you have the numbers in front of you right now, but I'm curious, like we talk about these one-game overreactions, when we look at some of the longer-term futures plays, like NFC North, for example, with all that we know, obviously the Lions are really good. The Packers are an unknown. The Vikings looked like they were better than many expected. And I've been asking, mm-hmm. was that the surprise team of the week? And the Bears won while not looking all that great. What are the expectations for this division as it stands now?
There were some really smart bettors that I pay attention to that move the Vikings more in their power rankings than anybody else in the NFL.
Wow.
Rufus Peabody is one of the best NFL bettors out there, and he has the Massey Peabody rankings that you can look up. He moved Minnesota from number 19 up to number 6.
What?
Why?
Yes, I know. It looks like an overreaction.
No, I'm actually asking why. Somebody's like, wait a sec, I thought Sam Darnold was bad, and now Sam Darnold is good?
Yeah, and they have the receivers. It's really about the defense. There's a lot of trust in that defense that they can hang around. The NFC North is fascinating because with the Jordan Love injury, the Bears move to the second favorite. They slot up there. The odds are about the same, but they move up to the second favorite. They win their first game. And then this question about the Love injury and then the Vikings look good, they have the same odds to win the division. They are both 6-1, the Vikings and the Packers. And then LaFleur's out there this week saying, hey, you know what? I'm not ruling anything out. Jordan Love could play without practicing. Doubt it's going to happen this week, but they didn't put him on IR. So maybe it's not 3 to 6 weeks. Maybe Jordan Love returns quicker than expected. If you go for the make the playoff odds in the NFC North, the longest shot of the four teams is the Packers, 2-1. Lot of overreaction involving Green Bay, and we really don't know what's going to happen with this injury.
I have a question about this overreaction thing, right? Because we talk about after 1 week, the sample size is so small. But guess what? After week two, the sample size is really small as well. So how much could a team that, you know, played better than expected last week, doing the same thing this week, how could that affect how we look at that team? I'm so interested in just the nuance of it all.
These markets move so much, and they put everything back up, all the Super Bowl, conference, division, win total odds up. So what's going to be the big talking point on Monday morning? The teams that are 0-2. How hard it is to make the playoffs when you're 0-2. And so that's going to be tough. We're going to see those numbers move a ton. And you're right. Two games is a small sample size. It could have been a tough schedule. A lot of people like the Falcons in the offseason. So they lose to Justin Fields in week one. And then what do the Falcons have now? They've got on Monday night the Eagles. Then I think it's the Chiefs after that. So we could easily be sitting there, the Falcons 0-3 to start the season, and they're the most talented team in the division, most likely. With so much football left, you'll probably get a good number on them to win the division still.
Hmm. Joe Ostrowski, have a successful weekend at what you do, and thanks much as always.
Thanks, guys. Enjoy it.
That is Joe Ostrowski. Next up, we have High Noon. I have two stories that fall under the category, in one way or another, of TIL, or hashtag Today I Learned.
Okay.
I'll bring them to you both.
I like to learn things.
Next.
So.
I did too. It's next on The Score.
Bernstein and Holmes. Middays 10 to 2 on Sports Radio 670 The Score in Odyssey Station.
I'll be back this way on Monday. We'll settle this then. Right there, out in the street, in front of the Palace Saloon.
Yeah, right. When? High Noon?
It's your last High Noon of the week on which we get you caught up of what we talked about so far on this Four Seasons Heating, Air Conditioning, Plumbing, and Electric Football Friday, presented by your local Ford dealers. And it's not a game, Illinois.com. Marshall Harris and I discussed Bears expectations, trying to get a reasonable awareness sort of where we were and where we are about this being probably a tough one for the Bears. We discussed Shane Waldron leading with accountability. And I thought a texter put it really well, leading with accountability rather than arriving at accountability. Adam Hoge gave us his perspective. We heard Richard Hightower on Velus Jones, had a great conversation with our guy Ron Hughley about the Texans, and Joe Ostrowski gave us his weekly tips.
It's high noon.
Couple instances of Today I Learned.
It's fun to explore. You read things, and that's part of the fun of being right online.
Yes, it is. And that's how I discovered this. Well, I want you to picture from the original Karate Kid.
Easy for me to do.
The original Karate Kid.
Yes.
Right? You've seen it. We've all seen it.
Yeah.
Do you remember one of the Cobra Kai guys, one of Johnny Lawrence's henchmen, not the get him a body bag guy, but the guy with the frosty bleach blonde curls?
Yes.
Dutch.
Yes.
Okay. That character's name is Dutch. Scowling, and you know, but he has a super bleachy hair. The actor who played Dutch died on Wednesday at age 63.
Oh.
His name was Chad McQueen, and I did not know until today that's Steve McQueen's son.
Oh. Okay.
I had no clue. And then all these pictures came, famous pictures of Steve McQueen behind the race car and at the racetrack and riding motorcycles and with this little kid. That's Chad McQueen. I had no clue.
I'm not surprised because that's how kind of Hollywood works. Like you're in somebody's family, it's the family business. I get all that. It's just, I didn't know who that was. I didn't know he died. I've learned a lot in the last 60 seconds.
Yes. But it was, he apparently died of the results of multiple injuries that he had suffered as a race car driver, motocross, wow, motorcycle driver. And eventually he had fallen and his body just sort of shut down, is what they said. But, and I was looking back at the history, if you know the history of Steve McQueen, a little bit like Paul Newman, in that they weren't just sort of dilettante race car guys. They were legit race car guys and did it as an avocation. So this was, and the racing was as much the family business for Steve McQueen as acting was, and that's how Chad McQueen had gotten into it. But I just thought, how did I not know that? You know, he was in Karate Kid 1 and 2 as this character, Dutch. I would not have known the character's name, but if you had shown me the character, and now when you look at him, yeah, of course that's Steve McQueen's kid.
I think
kid.
That's what's crazy is, he was 24 years old when he was in the Karate Kid. You always,
playing a high school kid.
You always forget, these people play, high schoolers. They're not.
Always.
They're adults.
I just found it really interesting, and it's something that I thought I should have known, and it was weird that I didn't, so... There you have today. You may have learned as well. And if you knew, you know more than I. Something else I learned today. I had no idea what torture devices exist U.S. Postal Service trucks have been for far too long. Because the USPS, after a ton of research and a ton of input and feedback from their these tortured mail carriers, have finally created a new postal truck designed to make their lives easier and humane and more comfortable. So if you, and I looked at the truck, like I said, that is the ugliest thing I have ever seen in my life. It looks like a duck-billed platypus. And the bumpers are all weird. It's like a Sprinter van with strange configuration of the windows. But apparently, and I know we do have a lot of mail carriers who have listened to the score and who have made the score part of their lives for a long time. But let me just say, when I see my mail carrier, I'm going to tell her. I'm going to say, I never knew. I had no idea.
You know how bad it was.
No, they weren't air conditioned. They catch on fire. They're not air conditioned. You can't stand up when you're in there. So people develop horrible back problems, all kinds of musculoskeletal problems. And in an effort to alleviate this and make an ergonomically designed, safe, responsible, reliable vehicle, they're doing it, and they're starting out. There's going to be some hybrid. Eventually, it's going to be all electric. They're starting in Athens, Georgia, but I guess they're getting rave reviews. Eventually, there's going to be 60,000 mostly electric models, and this will be the primary postal service delivery truck from Maine to Hawaii. And the current ones date to 1987, but they're, you know what the miles per gallon is for a current USPS mail truck?
The old ones, what?
The ones they're driving now.
I'm going to guess.
Yes.
There's residential. 18.
18. Try 9.
What?
9.
9 miles to the gallon?
9 miles
per gallon. No wonder they went electric. Like,
9! And they're scalding hot in the summer. There's only that little electric fan to circulate air. The mirrors that are mounted allow the driver to see around the vehicle, but the mirrors are constantly knocked out of alignment. How many of the vehicles caught fire last year? Just spontaneously caught fire.
What?
100.
Why?
I don't know, but 100 of them caught fire. So now these vehicles have airbags, 360-degree cameras, blind spot monitoring, collision sensors. The other things that the old vehicles didn't have, the ones in use now, they did not have anti-lock brakes.
Okay, I have questions.
They don't need anti-lock brakes, though. They're not going fast, right?
But like, if you are on icy roads through rain and snow and sleet and hail?
Yeah, because, you know, the mail, no matter the weather.
How at no point in the last almost 30 years did they update these vehicles? Like,
oh, the plan's been...
You know why? Because spending and budgets and people don't want... They want to starve the government of money and...
Well, here's why. It's a 10-year, $40 billion transformation process.
Mm-hmm. So 40, okay, so 40 why not start that 10 years ago? Or 20 years ago?
Do you understand how government works?
I'm aware.
How slowly aware the bureaucratic process is?
Like, I get that, but...
I want to say, if you are a mail carrier, I had no idea. I had no idea how poorly designed these were to make you miserable. Make you and no air conditioning.
Can I give you a quote from Avis Stoneham, who works in Athens, Georgia?
Yes.
Quote, "I promise you, it felt like heaven blowing in my face," Stoneham said of her first experience working in an air conditioned truck. Like, that's like,
yeah, of course they're getting rave reviews. Oh, they have air conditioning and they don't catch on fire. That's a come up there.
And you can stand up when you go in the back to get the mail and the packages. It's like, we really were doing this.
Can you imagine
that
they're like hunched over trying to get packages?
They are.
Makes my back hurt just hearing about it.
But it's really awful that we were doing that to civil servants.
It's really kind of unsurprising, though, when you, like, yeah, it is awful, but maybe it's me. I refuse to be surprised anymore.
Oh, here they come. Our guy, Mailman Dan. And he said 30-year-old aluminum boxes that get up to 130 degrees in the back with no AC, extremely dangerous. Yes, yes, yes. 262, I'm a mail carrier. I listen every day. Thanks for bringing attention to our plight. Yes, I had no idea.
How did nobody outside the actual mail carriers know about this?
Well, only the mail carriers, like family members, know about it. Like,
all right, yeah,
it's not. It's very inside baseball, but for mail trucks and the mail process.
So for 30 years, all our mail carriers have just been suffering.
Basically, it's like one of those occupations where if you're shorter, it's better for you.
I guess, but man. I'm happy for you, but I also feel terrible that you have been enduring that as long as you have. And another thing that I learned today. Before the Bears take on Houston, tune in Sunday evening from 5:30 to 7:20 after the Cubs game for your local Ford dealers pregame show right here on 670 The Score, presented by Busey Bank and Aurelio's. Join Mully, Olin Krutz, and Patrick Manley. They'll get you set for the game. Then immediately following the game, Mark Grody will join Olin and Manley with instant reaction on the Great Clips postgame show presented by Wonderverse. All of it can be heard on The Score and the Odyssey app. The Bernstein and Holmes show continues in just a moment with Marshall Harris in today. Kevin Fishbane of The Athletic is going to tell us his thoughts on the Bears and what he heard from Bears players and coaches this week. That's next. Keep it here on The Score.